From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of State of Belief listeners. Listeners just like you. We are thankful for you and all of our other listeners who are concerned about this show. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
People don't need to be with an organization. People don't need to be credentialed to be able to say the truth. Black people are in a state of emergency.
In the years since the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, a movement has grown around the slogan, Black Lives Matter. For some Americans, this movement is a source of inspiration and empowerment. For some others, it seems divisive and even misguided, and those opinions themselves often diverge along lines of race. A recent Huffington Post article's provocative headline, White America, What is Your Stake in Black Lives Matter?, tries to move us beyond that split. And I'll talk with the author, theologian Susan Brooks Thistleway.
I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
Kim Lawton is the managing editor and correspondent for the important PBS program Religion and Ethics News Weekly. As a longtime journalist covering religion, she is expert at the challenges facing new media when addressing this topic, especially in intensely partisan political seasons. We'll discuss this challenge on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
the ruling came from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver, Colorado. It stems from the Health and Human Services mandate requiring employers to provide coverage to sterilization, contraception, as well as abortion-inducing drugs in their health insurance plans.
The ongoing culture wars over reproductive rights have focused most recently on Planned Parenthood. But the front opened last year by the Supreme Court's misguided decision in Hobby Lobby has not been without its skirmishes. And although the latest events may not have made many headlines, they are potentially significant nonetheless. They involve Catholic organizations and state courts. And here with an update is author and historian Patricia Miller. Patty, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's a pleasure to be here.
Would you summarize the most recent court actions regarding Catholic institutions and contraception coverage?
Well, what round we're in with this right now is these institutions are now objecting to the exception to the exception, if you can believe that. They are objecting to having to fill out a form or send a letter to the government that tells the government they would like to take the exemption they have been granted from contraception coverage. They are completely free to not provide the coverage, and their insurer will provide the coverage. They are complaining about that form, and those cases had reached the appeals court level, the level below the Supreme Court. And at this point, every appeals court has rejected those claims as just patently ridiculous, that filling out a form is not a violation of their religious liberty. It's just basic government bookkeeping, record keeping. There must be some way to notify the government they would like to take advantage of the exemption they've been granted.
Do these rulings surprise you?
They don't surprise me. What surprises me was really the fact that these organizations would have the nerve to take this far. You know, they put their foot down and they stomped and they huffed and they puffed that they could not possibly provide contraception, although that was ridiculous. And the Obama administration gave in and said, okay, we'll make an exemption. But the fact that they challenged their accommodation really, I think, just took a lot of nerve. And appropriately, every court has kind of laughed them out, including some very conservative judges who have just said there is just no standing to say your religious liberty has been violated here. So, no, they're really not surprising decisions. Challenging this exemption at this level is really a PR stunt at this point. This idea that the religious liberty of these organizations is threatened has proved a very potent political selling point for people on the right. Hmm. They have now really gotten the idea out there that the religious liberty of, especially the nuns who sued, the Little Sisters of the Poor who sued, that their religious liberty is being violated. That is something you will hear all the GOP presidential candidates, from Ted Cruz to Rick Santorum on down, talk about. This religious liberty violation is a huge problem in our country, and these lawsuits prove this. So as long as those lawsuits are alive, they have an ability to talk about this.
Yeah.
What it shows, of course, is a dramatic misunderstanding of what insurance is. None of these organizations, such as the Little Sisters of the Poor, are personally being required to use contraception, but that's almost what they make it sound like.
Hmm. Patty, you recently wrote about how this issue is being addressed at Wheaton College. Does this give us any insights into how religious-affiliated institutions are planning to stand their ground, so to speak?
Well, Wheaton College is a little different from some of the other plaintiffs in these suits in that they're an evangelical college in Illinois. They're not Catholic, but some evangelical organizations have objected to the mandate as well, which is particularly interesting because their religious tenets, unlike the tenets of the Catholic Church, do not prohibit the use of contraception. They're just making a general moral statement that they don't believe contraception is right, especially emergency contraception, which they claim is an abortifacient, which is not correct. So what Wheaton College has decided to do is, because they lost their court case, they have discontinued their student health insurance program. This was a fairly small insurance program. It only covered about 500 of their 3,000 students. Most of the students get their health insurance through their parents. But it's important to see how far these institutions will go to make the point that their religious liberty is being violated. They pulled insurance out from 500 students who were, according to the Chicago Tribune, mainly international students who had no other way to get insurance, to make the point that their religious liberty is being violated, which is obviously a really questionably moral act, is to remove insurance access for these students so you can score a political point.
Yeah, yeah. But, Patty, I've often raised the question as to whether or not we would even be in such a discussion of this had the complaints and protests come from a coalition of Muslims, Hindus, and Unitarians rather than Catholic bishops and evangelicals?
I think that's a really powerful question that gets to the heart of this. If these complaints had come from Muslims, you would have seen the exact opposite thing happen. You would have seen lawmakers rushing to enshrine into law that we cannot follow the tenets of Muslim religion in any kind of civic law. There's already been instances where state legislatures have passed laws against following so-called Sharia law, which there's been really no instance of anyone trying to impose that in the United States. It just shows you it's in the eye of the beholder. When it's your religious tenets, it's fine to impose those on other people, but when it's religious tenets that you might be a bit more uncomfortable with, then suddenly that becomes problematic.
Absolutely. Do you see an emerging line of argument against the absolutist position of these religious employers that seems to be working?
It's really hard to say because, as I said, this is a PR stunt, so that you almost can't be too absolute with this. And it does not seem that people who are correctly interpreting the definition of religious liberty, which is the ability to worship freely and to conduct your religious practice freely, have, I don't think, effectively found a way to counter these arguments at this point. Mm-hmm. I think the voices are getting stronger to reinforce what has been the traditional definition of religious liberty. But what happens is there's now well over half the country that believes the definition of religious liberty is the right to impose your religious tenets on someone else, including someone who might work for you.
Yeah, yeah. How do you contextualize these decisions in a post-Hobby Lobby legal landscape?
Well, you know, Hobby Lobby obviously kind of threw down the gauntlet because it changed the definition of who could qualify for religious exemptions and religious consideration by the courts and moved that up from religious nonprofits to religious employers as well. And where this is really starting to evolve, and I think how we're going to see this play out over the coming years, is largely around the issue of LGBT rights, because religious employers, even for closely held for-profit companies, could argue it's a violation of their religious liberty to force them to provide insurance for a gay couple because they don't approve of gay couples, or to provide fertility treatment for a gay couple because they don't believe gay couples should have children. There really is nothing post Hobby Lobby to prevent someone from making that claim. The question is how far the courts will go with that, but if you extend the logic of Hobby Lobby, there really is no reason someone couldn't make that claim.
Let's set this in a broader context for a second. How does your study of the church's stance on contraception in the past inform what you see happening today?
Well, my study of it very much sees a long-term pattern here where the Catholic Church was not happy just teaching you shouldn't use contraception. As most people know, that is a widely ignored teaching. Huge majority of Catholics, something like 98% of Catholic women, have used contraception, but really working to ensure that people in the broader society can't get access to contraception through things like insurance. The fact that the Catholic Church particularly is heavily involved both in hospitals and increasingly in owning health insurance policies gives that a lot of leverage here, but from my way of looking at that, that's not really a religious practice or a religious teaching. They're really moving into using their leverage in a policy matter to say, you know, we own this health insurance plan, so we're not going to provide contraception. But if you look back on what the Catholic Church has been doing for 20 or 30 years, the evolution of that position is not particularly surprising. They kind of lost the hearts and minds of Catholics, so they've decided to kind of, you know, go for the policy jugular to just make sure that that insurance coverage does not exist for certain people.
Patty, if I understand correctly, the lower courts at this point are holding firm, and who knows what would happen if this goes back to the Supreme Court. Do you have any guesses of how this is ultimately going to play out?
Well, the most high profile of these cases has been the Little Sisters of the Poor, which was very cleverly picked by the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, which is the main public interest legal firm pressing these claims. Very clever to have a very self-sacrificing group of elderly nuns as kind of their poster children for this issue. They have lost their case. The court found, again, that there was no violation of their religious liberty in simply filling out a form. Beckett has indicated they will petition to the Supreme Court to hear this case. However, because no federal appeals court has found for the plaintiffs, there's really no disagreement here for the Supreme Court to sort out. The mainstream legal belief, it is unlikely the Supreme Court will agree to hear this case. Unless, of course, the conservative justices just want to make a statement. As you know, it doesn't take that many justices to agree to hear a case. Mm-hmm. Unless they want to make a statement and they want to bring one of these cases back just to override the federal appeals courts. That is a possibility, and that's going to be what's really fascinating to see how this plays out.
Patricia Miller is the author of the book Good Catholics, The Battle Over Abortion in the Catholic Church. Patty writes frequently on issues at the intersection of politics, sex, and religion, and her Religion Dispatches article examining how one Catholic college is trying to deny contraception coverage to students and staff is titled, Is Wheaton's Decision to End Student Insurance a Religious Liberty Ruse? Patty, it's always really good to have you on. So thanks for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Elton.
Kim Lawton is the managing editor and correspondent for the important PBS program Religion and Ethics News Weekly. Having spent many years covering these important issues, Kim brings an expertise that I think is essential as we work to watch out for inappropriate influences of religion on our politics and politics on religion as well. Kim, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Have you found this election cycle to be less or more impacted by religious language or context than previous races?
Well, there's certainly been a lot of it already, although I have to say this is the time, I think, in the cycle when you tend to get a lot of it. You know, not a lot of folks are paying attention on one hand, and on the other hand, these candidates are trying to do their best to rally the core groups that they need going into the primaries. So this is often a time when it happens. It just usually happens under the radar, and I think this time around, for a variety of reasons, there's been a little more attention to it. But, you know, we always have these various questions, you know, and answers by the candidates. Jesus is my best friend, you know, Jesus saved me. We do seem to have a lot of candidates this time around. And again, the sheer number of them, I think, is another factor. We have so many of them, and each one making these kind of appeals.
So, Kim, what challenges do you think news media face in trying to be responsible in addressing religion and politics?
Well, it's always a tricky line, and obviously this is an area that I cover and I've covered a long time, and there are some tough calls that you have to make, because as a reporter, I do think it's important that we find out basic information about a candidate that helps us as voters maybe know how a candidate might think or how he or she might make a decision. What are the priorities and the factors that they crank into those equations? I think those are valid questions, and I think religion plays into that. If that candidate is asking me to get to know them, it's legitimate for me to say, well, you've talked about your religious journey. How does it affect your life? How does it affect your policies? You know, how does it affect your character, you as a person? I think that's legitimate. But the tricky part is not getting into creating some kind of a litmus test, a religious litmus test for office, which is, of course, something that, you know, is against our constitutional values. You know, we don't want to get to a situation where the most devout candidate wins the election, and we don't necessarily want to give a platform for candidates to make those kind of claims. But, you know, one of the tricky things is the question that came up in the first GOP debate about, you know, do you hear a word from God? And the question was to tell you what to do first or something. And I think what the questioner was trying to get at is, you know, maybe does God speak to you or in some way influence your priorities? Now, how that got interpreted by the questioner was, do you hear a word from God? You know, and that seemed to really offend a lot of people. And the candidates certainly used it for their own purposes religiously. But, you know, it's sort of an interesting question. If you're a person who receives guidance from God, if you were president of the United States, how might that affect your policies? So I think some of the lines are tricky and hard to figure out.
Kim, in dealing with religion responsibly, and I know you want to do that, do you all talk about what kind of challenges you have to face in dealing with religion and politics? And if so, what are some of the things you say to your staff out of your long experience about, we've got to get this right?
For us, I think the number one principle is we are journalists, and we don't want to in any way become advocates, and that's for politics, but it's also for any particular religious point of view. I mean, our guiding principle for our program is that we consider religion a very important part of life for many people, and we know that it has a very strong impact on a lot of people. We understand understand that and believe that, but we don't advocate for any one particular strain of religion. Mm-hmm. So I think for us, that's number one. We just want to make sure that we're not in any way promoting or disagreeing with anyone's particular religious beliefs. And so that's, I think, the most important thing. And then, yeah, just trying to think about what would this question accomplish? Does this help us learn more about the candidate, or does this cross some kind of line? And I do think there are personal religious beliefs and practices that are private. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, you know, there was some talk when Mitt Romney was running for president, and members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints will have special undergarments that are used in certain sacramental ways. Is it appropriate to ask Mitt Romney about that? I would have said absolutely not. That's not about how that would affect his potential political or governing abilities. That's something that's personal and private. Mm-hmm. So some of those, you know, when Sarah Palin was running and she's part of the Assemblies of God, they speak in tongues. Is that germane to whether or not she'd make a good president? Questions like that, I think, are apart from the bound. But how your beliefs may affect your politics, how your beliefs may affect how you govern, I think that is appropriate.
Mm-hmm. As Americans have grown more diverse, do you think viewers of your program are more savvy than they used to be when it comes to different religions? Does that affect how you cover religion news today?
Well, I hope after watching our program for all these years that we have helped some people maybe become a little more savvy, a little more knowledgeable about faiths different from their own. Sometimes I wonder when I read the comments from the viewers, but we do try to present, you know, many different points of view. And I do think that because of the diversity in the country, there is interest among our viewers about what different groups believe or have to say about certain things or how they practice, what their rituals are. And that is one of the hallmarks of what we do. You know, sometimes it even happens within a faith, so that among Christians, sometimes I think people don't always know what other Christians believe, mm-hmm. or there's not just one form of Christianity. It's hard as a journalist, though, because you never know how much knowledge to presume. Mm-hmm. So when I'm writing a story, do I need to explain what the gospel is? Do I need to explain the book of Matthew or, you know, something like that? Some of the language that we use, we try to do something that is approachable by people that don't have a vast knowledge of religion, but we don't want to dumb it down so it's, you know, religion for dummies, for mm-hmm. people who do know more about religion. So sometimes that's a little difficult to figure out. How do I write something that people can understand no matter what their level of religious knowledge may be?
Mm-hmm. When I went to Washington to deal with religion and politics at the intersection of those two, it was like pulling teeth to get mainline journalists to write stories about religion at all. They didn't want to deal with religion and politics until we got really late in the last administration of President Clinton. And then, of course, after the turn of the century, we saw a lot of that. What is your take on the way mainstream journalists handle religion stories now?
Well, I think there has been an evolution. It is interesting. I mean, our program went on the air, if you can believe this or not, 18 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we did so because we did see a gap that this is this really important area of life, religion is. And many people, most people in the mainstream media, especially broadcast, especially television, really didn't pay attention to it. They really didn't cover it. And that's part of the reason why we came into being, to step into that gap. Today, I think you see more of it. What concerns me is it's often done by people who don't know that much about religion themselves. Mm. And there's always a debate. You know, as a journalist, I'm supposed to be able to be really good about covering a lot of different things and know a little about a whole lot of things. But with religion, there are some really particular things that people need to know. And especially in some of those early days you were just talking about, mm-hmm. I would see coverage about religion. When religion would enter the public square, it was like some of these reporters had no idea how to handle it. And mm-hmm. the ignorance that they showed in covering it was pretty amazing. I think some of that literacy has improved, but it is a problem. My biggest concern right now, though, is just whether there's support within the newsrooms to continue religious coverage. I mean, in so many of these newsrooms, there's budget cut after budget cut after budget cut, and so many of us are feeling that pinch. And a lot of editors and managers, I think, are looking at the different beats and saying, wow, do we really need somebody special just to cover religion? Anybody can cover religion. And I like to think that there is a specialty to it, just like you wouldn't have just anybody cover the business beat mm-hmm. or even the sports beat. So I hope that the news media in general keeps people who are specialists, who do know this beat and know how to cover it. I'm also troubled by another trend I see, even among some of the outlets that do cover religion, and I think that's great, but so much of that is commentary and opinion mm-hmm. and even analysis, and it's not straightforward reporting of religion. Mm-hmm. And there's a place, absolutely, for editorializing and commentaries and all of that, but I'm worried that we're losing the value of the news story that's checked out, that's balanced, that's, you know, done by people who are real journalists. Mm-hmm. And that troubles me that, you know, a lot of the websites and everything that focus on religion, again, that's terrific, but I'm hoping they don't sacrifice reporting, especially these days, as you say, when it is so important.
Kim, are there one or two religion stories that so far this year you feel have been either unreported or underreported in the mainstream process?
Well, we've seen reporting about the rise of religiously unaffiliated people mm-hmm. here in this country, and that's a very interesting trend. More and more people unwilling to say, I identify with this particular religion. Many of those people say, oh, I'm still spiritual or in some way believe in a higher power, but I'm just not organizing myself with this particular organized religion. I think that's very interesting, but one story that people aren't looking at is how then some of these institutional organizations, religious groups are trying to deal with that. Is that affecting them? Is that making them change how they do business, how they reach out, how they mm-hmm. sort of advertise for themselves? So I do think those are areas that are really interesting. Certainly the interfaith relations, I think, is an interesting story, not new this year, but you hear about the problems and the hostilities and the negative things, but we don't hear as much about groups coming together. Even in the wake of Ferguson, I saw a lot of white faith-based groups and African-American faith-based groups coming together for some really tough conversations about race, privilege, justice, policing, those kinds of issues. So I think while we feel very polarized sometimes, there are places where people are coming together on different levels, and maybe mm-hmm. that hasn't been explored as much as it should be.
Mm-hmm. Are there some themes in the world of religion and ethics that, in your opinion, we're going to need to keep a particularly close eye on in the next 6 months to 12 months?
I do think extremism is a concern because we look overseas, we see ISIS, of course, and so much of the stuff that's going around there. How is that affecting people here, Muslims here, but also non-Muslims who watch all of that? And how does that affect relations in local communities? That's one area. Also, we're seeing extremism as a problem for the Jewish community right now. And in Israel, there's having to be a crackdown against extremism because of a wave of hate crimes there. And as we're in now, as we started this conversation talking about the political cranking up of the electoral season, I do worry about the polarization mm-hmm. and just the language that comes out, as it always does in this season. And, you know, how does that affect us as citizens? I'm interested in Pope Francis. Obviously, everybody's interested in Pope Francis, but his upcoming trip to the U.S. and some of the themes he's been striking, those are very interesting and having a big impact well beyond the Catholic Church. I'm working on a story now about Jewish environmentalists who are so inspired by Pope Francis's papal encyclical. I mean, my goodness, when was the last time anybody in the Catholic Church read an encyclical, much less somebody in the Jewish community? So all of these things are going on. It's a very interesting and very robust time to be covering religion, that's for sure.
What made you want to be a journalist? And tell me about how you feel about what you're doing now, and what's most rewarding to you, Kim Lawton?
You know, it's sort of interesting. I didn't start out wanting to be a journalist. My family read, we had the newspaper, we watched the evening news. I don't know why, that was never a dream for me as a kid. But I wanted to see the world. I had this travel bug, and I wanted to go to interesting places and talk to interesting people. And it wasn't until my junior year in college when I was sort of flailing about trying to figure out what I wanted to do for a major, and I got put in some communications classes, and I got an internship, actually, in Washington, D.C. I just wanted to come to Washington, D.C., but I got an internship working at a radio news network, and it was exciting to me to be right there when things were happening and to be telling people about that. So that was sort of the impetus for becoming a journalist. I changed my major and did that. But then when my first job, I was a general assignment reporter, but there was just a lot going on in the world having to do with religion, and nobody else in the newsroom, A, knew about religion, or B, cared about it. And I was the newbie, so that became my story. So Billy Graham came to town for a visit. That became my story when, okay, now this is going to date me. Jews were protesting in front of the Soviet embassy back in the day. That became my story. And the more I did it, the more I found it interesting. And it just sort of became my beat, and it has been ever since. And I have to say, it is very rewarding. I mean, all these many, many years later, I still like covering religion. I tell people, when I cover religion, or because I cover religion, I cover war, I cover peace, I cover arts and movies and sports and foreign affairs and court cases and people's, you know, individual lives. And I meet really interesting people motivated by really, you know, sometimes interesting motivations, sometimes for good, sometimes for ill. And it just is still very exciting to be part of that beat.
Kim Lawton is the managing editor and correspondent for the important PBS program Religion and Ethics News Weekly. Kim, I really want to thank you for what you've done across the years, and I want to thank you especially for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you talking to me.
The Reverend Dr. Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite is a professor at the Chicago Theological Seminary, an incisive thinker and articulate writer. Susan often brings an unusual balance of both to the most important issues of our day. This was demonstrated once again in her recent Huffington Post column headlined, "White America, What is Your Stake in Black Lives Matter?" Susan, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's good to be back. Welcome.
Susan, of all the reactions sparked by the growing Black Lives Matter movement, I think some of the most disappointing have been often well-meaning white folks reflexively saying, well, of course Black Lives Matter, and then immediately jumping back into their rhetorical silos without ever really taking any time to think about their part in the problem. Maybe they say to themselves, the problem is that some other people are racist, but they don't go any further than that. Is what I'm saying part of the challenge that you're putting out there with your article?
Yes, I am, Walton. And you know how much I have been influenced by liberation theology.
Right.
And you acutely mention white liberalism, right? So white liberalism, many great things about it, but its chief flaw is that it seeks harmony, historically, theologically. So liberation theology, blessed Ana Maria Isasi Diaz said, la vida es la lucha, life is struggle. And so the difference between liberalism, which is seeking, you know, the language sounds good, common ground, what can we all do together, et cetera, is very bad at looking at structural change, systemic change. And I took this article pretty much whole hog out of an argument from critical race theory that I use in my new book, Women's Bodies as Battlefield. Mm-hmm. And I'm arguing that violence against women and war come from these common roots in Western culture that devalue the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took that argument and I put it in there to say to white liberals, don't look for what you can do for African Americans. Look how the same forces that are killing African American bodies are killing the body of the earth.
Hmm.
What's your existential crisis in this? Well, the very same theologies and philosophies and political strategies that are killing the body of African Americans, strangling them, shooting them, letting them die in prison. The very same mechanisms that are going to cause you to drown if you don't get the fact that this is what is the crisis of the body of the earth. So, you know, you've got your very bodied self has got a crisis, and maybe we can share in that crisis and not do something for or half of, right, which is very weak, which is a liberal strategy.
You know, Susan, I've got to ask, and I will stay within our own faith tradition just because I know more about it. In the Christian tradition, the body is both used as something that's a throwaway part of life, but it is also at the center of our understanding of the revelation of God and how embodiment is holy. Now, how do you get the centrality of incarnation, the body, on the one hand, and then use the same theology in that tradition to excuse whatever you do in getting rid of people's bodies?
Gustavo Gutierrez said, I'm suspicious of people who are not in the struggle for themselves. So I'm trying to say to white America, you, and I got this directly from Coates, and I strongly recommend that the listeners read this book. This is a letter from an African-American man to his son, and he is letting you listen to his fear that his son will be killed.
Hmm.
And it'll tear your heart out. I mean, any parent, any grandparent, any person of empathy it's just hard. It's a hard book to read because you feel his fear, and he lets you feel his fear.
Hmm.
So why does the world not value this young African American male's body? I saw at a demonstration, we're all one bullet away from being a hashtag.
Hmm.
Right. And, you know, and as a parent and a grandparent myself, I was just like, oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
And so he takes that concept of body and in the same way that I do, says, what is causing the despising of the body?
Hmm.
And no one today who is paying the slightest bit of attention can realize the body of the earth is also being despised. I mean, Pope Francis, very interestingly, in his encyclical, really, he, there's some problems with this, but he envisions the earth as a woman, as a female figure, and says that it's angry. It's very angry.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, darn right, Pope Francis. and you can feel that anger, and as Coates says, rising up out of the sea. And so don't from a liberation perspective, take the liberal option and say, oh, on behalf of, or we'll be, you know, we should include you, and we'll be sure our political agenda has something on what's happening to African Americans, right? That's a very liberal strategy. And instead, you got to sort of turn it around. And for you, Welton, and for me, what is in the very fabric of what is causing these black lives not to matter is going to kill us too.
Susan, you make a distinction. You draw a line between rhetorical and real racial progress. Expand on that a little, if you will.
Yes. Well, you know, rhetorical progress. I mean, I think we all saw the complete collapse of post-racial America, right? That's a rhetorical statement that was after the election of Barack Obama. And instead, what happened was the underbelly of the unsolved crisis of racism from the time of slavery actually bubbled to the surface and became much more visible. I mean, it was actually the reverse of what people thought post-racial America would be. And the attacks on President Obama, either coded or uncoded, as his race became a symbol of resistance to his policies. Real change is you've got to look at the Guardian newspaper in England now has a website on the American body count of people killed by American police. And it's so staggeringly higher than any other, quote, quote, developed country. And so, you know, if you want to see progress, that has to go down, right? There has to be a lower body count. And that's not even progress. That's just stemming the bleeding so we could get to progress. Progress is numbers on salaries, on jobs, on employment, on, I mean, what do people say about Baltimore, right? If you're between 18 and 30, 40%, I don't want to misquote a statistic, but it's a staggeringly high unemployment rate. Rhetorical progress is just we need to move forward on race. That's just baloney.
So we take seriously what you're saying, and there is some resolve that we're going to deal with this honestly. What do we lose if some of us absolve ourselves too quickly of any responsibility regarding racial injustice?
Liberal guilt can also not be all that helpful in that, taken to extremes, it can be paralyzing. And so, you know, I'm trying to push people a little past that. I'm saying, what's your stake, right? So it's a slightly different thing than what's your blame, which is get over it, right? Yes, white privilege exists. It's lethal in this country. But what is your stake in a solidarity that changes that? You've got a stake in this because for you and me as Christians, this is the faith response. The faith response is what's our deep community here? What's our deep solidarity? And that very much, I think, has to be there is an acquisitiveness, an attempt to take the body of non-dominant races, of women, and commodify it. And, of course, the earth is being commodified and exploited. Two guests. And, you know, that one of the things that Coates writes about is how profitable slavery was. How profitable. And, you know, we as Christians are being a hard sell these days to say in any way greed is bad. You know, I mean, that's uphill. It's unbelievably uphill. And, you know, you've got to recognize there's a reason why. And it's not just, you know, you think you're going to solve this with body cameras. Technology is not going to save you. I'm not opposed to body cameras, but, you know, Eric Garner was choked to death on camera, right? I mean, it's just, and what? What do people ultimately do about that?
I've got about 90 seconds left, and I've got to ask you to tell us a little bit more about your new book, Women's Bodies as Battlefield, Christian Theology and the Global War on Women. In 90 seconds, tell us why we've got to read that book.
Well, the war on women is actually a war because, again, there is a body count. But I think that violence against women also helps us understand that war today is dirty war. That is, it's a civilian war. It is ISIS capturing, assaulting, and selling young women. They've weaponized women's bodies. But in the same way, you've got to realize that the violence in Baltimore, the violence in St. Louis, this is also a dirty war. Mm-hmm.
The Reverend Dr. Susan Brooks Thistlewaite is a professor of theology at Chicago Theological Seminary. Her Huffington Post article is headlined, White America, What is Your Stake in Black Lives Matter? And we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Susan, you do such good work, and you always enlighten us. I thank you for taking the time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, Wilton, for having me, and thank you for staying on, I think, what are the crucial issues of belief today.
Now, before we go, many of us were deeply saddened to learn that Jimmy Carter has been diagnosed with cancer. In the decades since he left office, the 90-year-old former president has been a seemingly ageless force for good, whether in traveling the world promoting peace and justice or in proclaiming the need for inclusivity and acceptance for all in the name of his Baptist faith. You know, Jimmy Carter is nothing less than a national treasure. If you pray, this would be a good time to do so. For a man who unashamedly, sometimes awkwardly, but usually more effectively than he's ever gotten credit for, has devoted himself to the welfare of our nation and of humanity as a whole. Our thoughts are with President Carter, his wife Rosalind, and their family at this most difficult time. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Boy, what a good group of guests and how much we've learned. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a very sincere thank you. It helped keep this show on the air. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping our show on the air with its uniqueness and demonstration of civility and care about how religion gets treated in the media and by the media. If you find value in what you're hearing, and if you think it's important that more people hear what you're hearing, then I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and share the stories you find compelling with your friends. Tell them to come on in and listen to the show and get into the conversation. We really need you to help spread the word about this show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was. Oh,